Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. In an age of unparalleled innovation and advancement in digital technology and web-based interactive platforms, why did the first iteration of the Affordable Care Act website, healthcare.gov, fail so miserably? For the first time in history, a president has had to stand in the Rose Garden to apologize for a broken website, wrote today's guest Clay Johnson in a recent op-ed article in the New York Times. He goes on to explain, but healthcare.gov is only the latest episode in a string of information technology debacles by the federal government. Indeed, 94% of large federal information technology projects over the past 10 years were unsuccessful. More than half were delayed, over budget, or didn't meet user expectations, and more than 40% failed completely. Much of the problem, Clay Johnson says, has to do with the way that government buys things. So why is the government's way of contracting for web technology so broken, and what can be done to fix it? Joining us is Clay Johnson, who's a former Presidential Innovation Fellow and lead programmer for Howard Dean's 2004 campaign. He's also the chief executive officer of the Department of Better Technology, which is a nonprofit that develops technology for governments. He's also the author of the book, The Information Diet, A Case for Conscious Consumption. Hi, Clay.
Hi there. How are you?
Thank you for joining us. We're also going to be joined by Abhi Nemani, who's co-executive director of Code for America. That's the technology organization dedicated to reinventing government for the 21st century. Hi, Abhi.
Hi. How are you doing?
Thank you both for joining us. Let's start with you, Clay, and let's do the forensics on how healthcare.gov was actually created. Can you tell us what was the process for that?
Well, in the beginning, there was a law called the Affordable Care Act, and it was passed. And after that law was passed, the Department of Health and Human Services was tasked to figure out how to build the federal exchange. Now, at the time, each state, the way the law was written was with the intent of each state would build its own sort of healthcare.gov, its own website. In fact, many states did. I think about 17 states did. But most opted not to for a variety of reasons, some of them political, some of them financial, and some of them for any other reason.
I believe it was 25 that opted out, yeah.
25 opted out. So the Department of Health and Human Services tasked the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services to build this website, since they had done so before with Medicare Part D. Now, this is where it starts to get a little wonky.
And what year is this about?
This is 2010.
Okay, so right after the passage of the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
Okay.
So this is where it starts to get wonky. Is the way that government buys things is through a system called procurement, acquisitions.
Like you put out an RFP, a request for proposals type of thing.
Right, you put out proposals, and then people can bid on them, and there are a set of rules as to how that bidding works and who can get the contract and that kind of thing. Well, the federal government, in this case, said, "Well, we've already done all that work, and if we do that again for a website of this magnitude, it will actually take us longer than we have to actually build the website. It'll take us longer just to find the vendor than it would to actually build the website. So why don't we use an existing contract that we already have in place with one of our partners?"
So with somebody who did the Medicare Part D website.
Right.
Okay.
That's right. So they chose a company called CGI Federal to do it. CGI Federal is a government contractor, a very large government contractor, and they opted to do it. The whole process was only open to about 16 different companies had the ability to were eligible to bid on this kind of work because they already had the existing contracts.
Let me ask you a question, Clay. I had heard that the government, the Obama administration, did not go to, say, a Google or one of these companies with existing technological knowledge because they were afraid of conflict of interest issues. Is that accurate?
Well, I mean, I think that it's important to I don't know whether that's accurate or not, but I think it's important to understand that the reason why we have these rules and regulations are is because of those conflict of interest rules. Now, I don't think that Google is particularly qualified to make healthcare.gov. You know, they're not a healthcare exchange company. They're a search engine company. They're not. They don't do consulting for people. They build internet platforms. We wouldn't go to Yahoo to build this. We wouldn't go to Google to build this. We wouldn't go to Pandora to build this because that's not what they do. But you would go to somebody like HashRocket, who's a nice professional services company that does technology consulting, or the company that I helped start, Blue State Digital. We did campaign websites, including the President's Own campaign website. You know, those are the kinds of companies who would ordinarily build this kind of stuff in the private sector, but they weren't even eligible to do this kind of work in the public sector because they haven't jumped through all the hoops and stuff like that. And that's part of, I think, the issue as to how we got into this space, into the problem. We ended up with the sort of fiasco that we got to is we have such a limited market that and such a convoluted system for winning these contracts that the contracts generally go to the people with the best lawyers, not the people who can do the best job. And while the system is set up to have a great level of integrity and intent by making it so that we can't just elect somebody and then they just give contracts to their buddies, no one wants that. But what we've done is we've ensured that those contracts only go to a certain group of people who have managed to navigate the system so perfectly that they've locked everybody else out.
So do you think, Clay, that the fundamental problem that we had with the original rollout of healthcare.gov had to do with the way that the government procures these contracts?
I think that that's probably about 80% of the problem. I think the other 20% of the problem is the way that government hires technology personnel on the inside. So how do we get the sort of, you know, the Google-level project managers on the inside of government coming in and managing the contractors and figuring out who to select? So, you know, part of the problem is, a big part of the problem is there's just not enough talent that government can hire as contractors. And the other part of the problem is that there's not enough talent on the inside who can figure out the good contractors from the bad ones.
And let me bring Abhi Nemani, who's co-executive director of Code for America, and your organization is trying to reinvent government for the 21st century. Abhi, do you want to weigh in on what you think the fundamental flaw with the rollout of healthcare.gov was? Oh, did we lose Abhi? Okay,
yeah,
sounds like we lost Abhi. So, oh, hi, Abhi. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I missed the question because my phone just died. Sorry.
Well, welcome back. What do you think was the sort of fundamental problem that healthcare.gov illustrated for us in terms of how the federal government does technology?
It's, you know, to me, it's a question about how you approach technology, right? Do you just sign a check and say, build this thing for me? Or do you do what most modern technology companies do, which is user-driven development, right? Mm-hmm. Build something small, test it, see what works, see what doesn't, and then what works, build more of that, right? And we don't have that practice inside our government right now, and that's what has to change. We've started looking at technology not as something you just kind of shut your eyes and sign off, but as something you continually do on an ongoing basis.
Well, I mean, that's how it ultimately did work out.
Yeah, well, after the initial failure, right? So it initially failed, and then they inculcated this practice of small iterative development, right? And we need to make that less of a last stop or a last-ditch effort and more of an ongoing practice that we take seriously inside our government.
And, Clay, when you wrote your op-ed in the New York Times, you said 94% of large federal information technology projects over the past 10 years were unsuccessful. How does that compare with the private sector?
Well, you know, there's a strong correlation between the larger the project, the more likely it is to fail. And this has been documented time and time again. This kind of failure is not unique to the public sector. ask the Hershey Corporation what happened to them a month before Halloween in 1999 when they integrated a large IT system like this one that, you know, managed their accounting and shipping and stuff like that, and essentially missed Halloween. Or ask Hewlett Packard what happened when they tried to do something similar in 2000. I think it was 2005 or 2006, and the same kind of thing happened, and they missed several millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars worth of revenue just because of some IT glitches. The thing that I think people really ought to be thinking about and worrying about is, you know, when we're, as software continues to eat the world, if that software is glitchy inside of government, then lots and lots of bad things can happen. The good news is that when things happen inside of a private corporation, you have the ability to not buy their stuff. But inside of government, you have to wait in order to vote them out. And a lot of damaging and bad things can happen.
One of the damaging things that seems to be happening is that Americans are losing confidence in government. A new poll out last week said Americans enter 2014 with a profoundly negative view of their government. In the new poll conducted by AP NORC, Center for Public Affairs Research, 70% said they lacked confidence in the government's ability to make progress on important problems and issues facing their country in 2014. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we're talking about how government can best use new technology. How do we reform the processes? What is working? Where are the models? And we want to invite you to join our conversation. If you're a programmer, what insights do you have on how websites could work better, how government can best use technology? 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number. It's 866-798-8255. And why is it important for governments from federal to local to get web technology right? How do you think they should do it? Where is government tech working well, and where is there room for improvement? Again, the number to join our conversation on Your Call is 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. We're speaking with Clay Johnson, who's the author of The Information Diet, A Case for Conscious Consumption, and Chief Executive Officer of the Department of Better Technology, and Abhi Nemani, who's Co-Executive Director of Code for America. So, Abhi, can I ask you to tell us how local cities and states are doing tech differently than, say, the Fed, and especially who's getting it right? Are there examples?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think the one thing to keep in mind is healthcare.gov happens city to city, state by state every year, right? So New York City had city time that cost them $100 million plus that didn't go anywhere. The state of California had a document management system that cost them a couple of $100 million and didn't go anywhere. So this isn't an isolated problem, right? This isn't just the federal government not doing it right. It's a problem in the way in which government approaches technology. That said, we're seeing things start to change. And they're starting to change at the local level. So, for instance, the city of Philadelphia has started to put its RFPs, right, for request proposal, on what's called GitHub. It's like the most common developer platform out there. It's where a lot of open source hackers go. It's like where the cream of the crop are.
Mm-hmm.
They put their requests for new technology on that platform. Not some hidden away government website, but right where the hackers are, right? And they're starting to see great results. Kansas City has just, for instance, reformed its approach to technology purchasing. San Francisco has built this entrepreneur-in-residence program, which is inviting new technologists and developers into the city to help them solve problems. And, of course, us at Code for America, we're sending 30 to 40 developers across the country every year to solve problems that the cities have, and we're seeing really dramatic results. And those
can you give us an example of one of those projects and dramatic results?
Sure. So in San Francisco, so imagine the enrollment in the food stamp process, right? So you enroll through this process and you get food stamps in the city, but you have to keep reporting every quarter how you're using the stamps and whether or not you're meeting all the obligations. Often, if you miss any of the one different obligations, like you don't check one box, you get kicked off. And so you'll show up at the grocery store trying to buy food for your family over Thanksgiving, for instance, and find out that you can't because you've been kicked off, right? That's a humiliating and terrible feeling for somebody going through that process. And the only notice that they get, someone who's going through that process, is a letter. And I can show you guys a copy of it, a letter that's hard to understand, hard to read, and one that all you can do is go stand back in line at the food stamp enrollment center trying to get rolled back in. Well, what our fellows did is they understood that process, realized how big of a challenge this was for the citizens, and built a simple text app. You get a text message 3 days before you're going to get kicked off that says, hey, your certification is up for review. Is everything okay? Just that simple. It's not complicated technology. The technology here isn't what's serious. It's the interaction. And they get that text, and then they can call in and say, hey, I don't know what's going on. And it's turned out hundreds of people have now gotten that message and gotten themselves re-enrolled in the program. So it's not the most crazy technology. It's not super complicated. But it's the kind of technology that changes people's lives, right? It means that they don't have to get kicked off of food stamps. It means that they can keep enrolled and get the services they need. And that's the kind of service we think citizens should have from technology in the 21st century.
And is anybody, Abhi, is anybody working on developing a sort of Yelp system for social services bureaucracies? Is anything along those lines being done?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So actually, we are. So actually,
that's called Yelp.
The San Mateo Project. The San Mateo project we did this last year was just that, right? Because social services information, like where you can get food stamps, where you can get job training, it's really hard data to get your hands on. It's sometimes in nonprofits, it's sometimes in the government, sometimes in churches. It's not unified. So if you're somebody looking for that service, it's really hard to search for it. So our fellows in San Mateo did this project called OHANA, which is opening up...
Called what, Abhi?
OHANA.
OHANA?
Yeah, it's just ohanaapi.org. And with that data, then you can start integrating with Yelp. You can start integrating with Google, right, and put it in the hands of people who really need it.
And the NSA, the National Security Agency's spying technology, seems to be an example of government technology that's working very efficiently. So is tech different depending on which federal government agency is using it, Clay?
I think that's a really important point. I don't know whether it's, you know, I don't think any of us actually can point out whether it's working efficiently or not. But I do think that the point of government not being monolithic is a really important point. When people, when they talk about government, generally talk about it in the wrong way. They think that government is one big thing, and it's not one big thing. You know, the federal government has agencies that compete with each other. It's more like you're talking about an industry, the industry of government, and the industry of government has, you know, organizations in it called the called local government and called the Environmental Protection Agency and called the Department of Defense, and they all have different ways of doing things and different best practices. I think part of the thing that gets us into these situations is about how we elect people. You know, we elect people to get in a car and drive us somewhere. You know, candidates say, I want to take you to the promised land. They drive us somewhere in the sort of metaphorical car, but we never, ever elect someone to step out of the car and look under the hood and see how it works. And as such, we have a government that that's running on an engine that hasn't been fine-tuned in a while. And I think Code for America's efforts and the efforts of a lot of various organizations now are seeing the promise of new technology and going, hey, this can really affect the way that citizens have, but also affect the internal processes inside of government. So, you know, whether or not the NSA is doing a good job or a bad job at efficiently spying on people, I don't know. But because I haven't, you know, I haven't seen the software. I don't know how it works. But I do want for people to, you know, as Abhi said, I want for the right people to be able to get their food stamps well, and I want the lines to be short at the DMV, and I want for healthcare.gov to work when they say it's going to work. And these things aren't going to change unless we start putting a little bit more of a focus, I think, in elections and in how we choose our politicians based on the efficacy, how effective we think they'll be at their jobs, not just how well they speak in a debate.
Well, you point out, Clay, that the website technology that Obama used to win the elections was more advanced than healthcare.gov. And I think that a lot of people sort of expected this kind of government to be better at tech because they were so good at it in the election. So can you compare and contrast sort of what the differences are?
Well, you know, the campaign doesn't have any procurement rules. It has presidential campaign has some regulations it has to follow around financial disclosure and how much money it can take from whom and that kind of thing. But what it doesn't have is, you know, an RFP process where it has to select the lowest bidder, or it has to. The federal government has this thing called a protest period where after a vendor has been selected, the government has to wait for 2 weeks or some set period of time for the losing companies to protest that bid and then take it to court if they'd like. Campaigns don't have that kind of thing. And so the president and his team was able to evaluate vendors much more quickly based on social networks, based on prior work recommendations, and hire the people that they thought were the best for the job in a way that was not particularly cumbersome for those vendors. In the federal space, it's exactly the opposite of that. To start contracting with the federal government right now, the first thing that you have to do is go to a website called sam.gov, S-A-M. It's like Uncle Sam, sam.gov. And anybody can take a look at that website, which, by the way, cost $171 million. Anyone can take a look at that website, and basically 90% of the people who look at it will just go, any technologist will look at that website and just go, I quit right away. They just won't even bother to register and start contracting with the government. And as such, we
because why?
Because it's ugly, it's cumbersome, it's hard to use. There's an 80-step process right now just to be able to register to bid on contracts, not to be awarded those contracts, just to be able to register to bid on those contracts. And, you know, that particular that problem is prohibiting the same kind of innovation that has changed our daily life from entering in the system that makes the rules for us.
Well, I would imagine that the debacle with healthcare.gov is forcing a rethinking of some of this within the Obama administration, right?
Well, here's hoping. The people I've spoken to inside of the administration are very keen on making some changes, but keep in mind that these regulations were built to make it to not be easily changed. They come from the early 1900s, and they were set up to make it so that the political decisions and the operational decisions of government were kept sort of separate. And it's an important part, checks and balances, that we don't have a form of cronyism. You don't want for Obama to get elected and then give his give technology contracts to his CTO for his campaign,
and
because that's cronyism, right?
That's Clay Johnson, who's Chief Executive Officer of the Department of Better Technology and author of The Information Diet, A Case for Conscious Consumption. We're also speaking with Abhi Nemani, who's Co-Executive Director of Code for America. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we will be right back after this short break.
Listening to Your Call here on Local Public Radio. If you'd like to weigh in, take part in today's conversation, here's the number, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear new voices. And if you prefer to write rather than call, you can send an email to feedback, yourcallradio.com. BBCWorld.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, it's the BBC's World Have Your Say. On today's program, we'll be focusing on Iraq and more specifically Fallujah after the Iraqi government has reportedly lost control of the city to Al-Qaeda-linked fighters. Also in the program, a look at one of the most viewed stories on news sites today, the polar vortex that's gripping North America. That's the BBC's World Have Your Say coming up in 30 minutes here on KALW San Francisco.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow, we'll talk about financial regulation, what works and what doesn't, and how will implementation of the Volcker Rule change the financial industry. On Wednesday, why are so many people still poor in America? We're going to mark the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty initiated by President Lyndon Johnson, which included programs like food stamps and unemployment insurance. But the poverty rate has only fallen from 19% back then to 15% in half a century, and children remain at the highest risk. So did the war on poverty fail, succeed? How do people successfully move out of poverty? Today, we're talking about how government should do web technology. We're focusing on the failures of the Affordable Care Act website initially and how the government can do better with tech. We'd like to hear your thoughts on how do we improve technology in the federal government. How is it working in your state and city? 866-798-8255 is our toll-free number, 866-798-TALK. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, and you can post comments at yourcallradio.org, which is where we have information on all of our guests today. We're speaking with Clay Johnson, who is the author of The Information Diet, A Case for Conscious Consumption, and he is Chief Executive Officer of the Department of Better Technology, which is a nonprofit that develops technology for governments. Abhi Nemani is Co-Executive Director of Code for America, and that's the technology organization dedicated to reinventing government for the 21st century. Again, the number to join our conversation is 866-798-8255. And if you're a programmer or you work in tech, what insights do you have for reforming how the governments do technology? 866-798-8255. And we got a comment. When I worked for Yahoo, almost every employee could change the front page. The company was nimble. I know it's bigger now, but now I work for the government, and from fast and easy, well-tested and intuitive to, well, the opposite never ceases to frustrate me. We have systems that literally make me cry. They waste money and time and still don't do what they need to do. Anyone who was surprised that healthcare.gov didn't work well hasn't used a government system before. The best and brightest IT professionals do not work for the government. So, Abhi, do you want to respond to that comment?
I think that's changing. And I think it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy that if we think that no one interesting is working for government, no one will. Mm. So I think about John Tovo, who was the CTO of Chicago. This is a guy who was the head of smart cities for IBM, very talented guy doing amazing stuff. Or Brett Goldstein, who was the CIO and CDO for Chicago, who is the former CTO of OpenTable. So you're seeing talented people go into government. I think the challenge is we have to change the norms around what we think a government work or a government job is. And we have to make it seem more creative, more innovative, more open to doing something interesting. Because if we keep describing it as something that you can't get anything done in, no one's going to want to do it. Mm. Right?
Mm-hmm. And do you get buy-in from local governments when you work with them for Code for America?
Definitely. I mean, and we're seeing mayors specifically, and I think this is an interesting evolution right now, is that you're seeing mayors realize that the federal government, that Washington, isn't going to deliver the kind of services and support that they want or they need, right? So the mayors have to step up. So you're seeing mayors like Greg Fisher in Louisville or Mayor Nutter in Philadelphia say, you know, Washington, if you're not going to help us get our job done, we're going to do it ourselves. And they're doing it. So Mayor Fisher in Louisville, for instance, has a bunch of folks who are really supportive of his agenda. So Ted Smith is his chief innovation officer. They've worked on using, this is a cool story, they use asthma inhalers. They've added GPS locations onto them to help get a better sense of air quality throughout the city. His CIO, Beth Niblock, and Teresa Reno-Weber, who's his head of data, have helped him understand crime and blight data to inform his policy around those important issues. So you're seeing mayors really start to deliver in a way that you wouldn't expect them in the past, but they have to now, given the state that they're in.
And technology has so many options now to make our lives better. And right here in Northern California, we're at the center of technological innovation. Where locally would you say that government is really getting it right?
So here in California?
Yeah, right. Here in Northern California, Santa Cruz, San Francisco, Oakland, Hayward.
So I'll be a bit biased here and tell you about the story in Oakland that we did this year. So in Oakland, the fellows went in and tried to understand this problem of FOIA. So FOIA stands for Freedom of Information Act. Every government has a responsibility to respond to public requests for documents or information that they have. And in general, if you ask any government employee, they say, this sucks, right? This is terrible for them because there's a lot of information that's produced that often isn't organized in an easy way. The fellows went in and said, well, let's make this problem a bit easier, not only because it'll make the life of the bureaucrats easier, but also because it'll open up transparency into the government. And they built this tool called RecordTrack. It's records.oaklandnet.org. And what it does is it says you can submit an information request for the government, right? How many shootings were there last week in this part of Oakland? Or what was the payroll information for that department in the Oakland City government? Typically, this information would be asked by a phone call that would go nowhere and take too much time. Well, they built an easy application that made that publicly available and transparent, and it's gotten dramatic changes in the way in which that information is delivered. Not only are there magnitude order higher information requests, but the time for delivery has gone down dramatically as well. And so what that's done, and we asked City Councilman Libby Schaff afterwards how that affected the population, she said, this changed our relationship with citizens. It changed the way we interact. And that's, I think, what's really powerful about civic technology, right, is that you can change the way the government and the citizens relate to each other and those norms.
And let's go to one of our callers, Ruth Ann and El Cerrito. Welcome to your call. Hi.
Hi there. Good morning, Holly.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask the guests or put out there why they thought there were so many hiccups and the big glitch with the Affordable Care rollout, where there was the history beforehand of government technology working, I can speak from personal experience, way more smoothly with processing of Social Security claims and Medicare claims, and the whole that all of my doctors are always telling me that there's the electronic records and I always get electronically generated forms spit out on my Medicare explanation of benefit forms, and I think it's all computer generated, and I'm wondering why I've been receiving those for the past, say, 20 years, and minus problems that are usually human-based, why is that so much smoother than what happened with the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I can answer that. I think a lot of various and problems like these, the solution isn't particularly simple or concise. But I think the first part of the problem is that you had a short timeline. That the federal government had only about 18 months really to build this project, and they had to talk with a lot of various different systems in order to make this project successful. A lot of Social Security systems, a lot of the systems you just mentioned, a lot of Social Security systems, a lot of Medicare systems, a lot of tax systems. This is the most sort of consolidated amount of information that has existed in the federal space. The second problem was a lot fewer states participated in building their own exchanges than was originally intended. And as such, a lot more people used the website than was originally estimated when the site was spec'd out. And those specs mean a lot more in the federal government than they do in the private sector because the federal government's a lot less agile. The way that the federal government builds products is generally by drafting requirements, and then the people who are building the projects basically go down a list and build all the requirements, and then you're done. But those requirements don't usually change in the midstream, whereas I think the private sector has moved more towards an agile form of development where you build a little bit to get to a minimum viable product, and then you evolve with user interaction or with citizen interaction as time goes by.
And what you're saying is that the way that government contracts work, that there isn't that kind of a lack of flexibility.
Yeah, it's very hard to discover a legal mechanism which would allow for government to do that while still, quote-unquote, safeguarding the taxpayers' dollars. However, I would be hard-pressed to find a way that we could say that healthcare.gov safeguarded anybody's dollars.
Well, I wanted to ask both of you about that. It, you know, Clay, you talk about a lot of examples of, you know, millions of dollars to create websites and technology that ultimately didn't succeed. So how much money are we talking about being wasted? And in part because we're trying to protect taxpayer dollars.
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. Let's talk about the healthcare exchanges. The state of California spent $300 million on its exchange, a little over, I think, $300 million on its exchange. The federal government spent around $300 million on its exchange. Numbers have gone anywhere from, I've heard $96 million to $600 million. But I think it's probably about $300 million from the estimations that I've done.
So the same to create Covered California as to create healthcare.gov?
Yep.
Okay.
All told, the states spent around all the states that opted out spent around opted in and built their own exchanges spent a total of $1.1 billion. The federal government spent $300 million making the site, another $200 million fixing it. So I think we're close to about $2 billion as to what the IT cost of the Affordable Care Act ended up at. At a larger level, I think we're talking about tens of billions of dollars have been spent on failed IT projects, if not hundreds of billions of dollars, depending on how long you stretch time out and whether you adjust for inflation. But this is a problem that goes back to buying frigates, not buying websites. This is an old problem that just now I think we're getting the ability to fix through the use of technology and through the use of transparency. Look at it this way. It was very hard to have an instant online auction for a Pez dispenser up until about 15, 20 years ago. Now we can, you know, auction off, you know, our socks, our used socks, if we want to, on eBay. And technology is doing the same thing to government, where I think we can build faster, better procurement practices that bring more people to the table and create more opportunities for more people. Procurement is supposed to do two things. The first thing it's supposed to do is safeguard the taxpayers' dollars. It's supposed to make it so that taxpayers can feel that their tax dollars have been spent on contractors in a fair and equitable way. And the second thing that it's supposed to do is get the government the most social value for the buck. So the other thing that that government does when they're doing these contracts is they set aside some contracts for minority-owned businesses or women-owned businesses or small businesses or local businesses. But unfortunately, the technology systems that are running the back end of procurement are the same technology systems that you see with healthcare.gov. And so my take is that those back end systems, the engine that's running this stuff, need to be upgraded to make the bureaucrats, enable the bureaucrats to make better decisions. And then we can go forward and sort of opening up the doors to more opportunities for people. And I think we'll drive down the cost for all this technology as a result.
You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. You just heard from Clay Johnson, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Department of Better Technology and the author of The Information Diet, A Case for Conscious Consumption. We're also joined by Abhi Nemani, who's Co-Executive Director of Code for America. And we're talking about how best to use technology in government for we the people. We're also joined now by Fred Mindlin, who's Associate Director for Technology Integration at the Central California Writing Project. Act. And it's part of the Department of Education at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Hi, Fred.
Hello.
Hey,
nice
so I know that you look at what's happening in the public education system. So what is working and what isn't when it comes to integrating digital tech into classrooms and education?
Well, I think the thing that is so exciting about the changes that the internet and connectivity have brought are the potential for students to be able to express themselves and communicate with each other. Unfortunately, most of the attention has been put onto using technology in ways that I think are basically bogus, that is, trying to replace teachers with technology delivery systems and trying to evaluate teachers with technological wizardry that is pretty well clear does not work. And I wanted to jump in with another aspect of the failure of the Obamacare website, which I think goes down to a problem that's even greater in the education world, which is the technology hustle, proposition that technology is somehow going to solve all of these problems in a way that is just never actually borne out in practice. Somebody fed Obama this line about how using the website would be as easy as Travelocity or Amazon, and in fact, one of the big problems there is that the core technology that the whole healthcare system depends on is this patient data information system, which probably dates back to the 1970s. And so building any system that will work on the modern web that has to interface with something that is that old requires a great depth of technological sophistication that nobody really warned him about. He bought a line from some technology hustler.
And it seems like that's a piece of the inherent flaw in the way the contracts are awarded. I want to get to as many callers as I can well, in our remaining time. So let's go to CJ in Oakland. Hi, CJ. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I just had a comment and a question. My comment is that in all the news media that I've heard, including even public radio and public media, I've been listening to just they've excoriated President Obama for this failure, and all this time I've been thinking, well, and in fact, just as your guest said, I've been thinking, you know, there have been many major failures of large computer events, like your guest said about Hershey's and everything, and I never heard like what was behind that or anything. It was just like, oh, this Obama has failed. So politically, I felt like it was very skewed against Obama. I didn't hear much about
impersonalized, right?
Better. Exactly. So that was my comment. And then my question is, the other thing about the law was that the availability of the states to opt out and throw the problem onto the federal government. I mean, I'm wondering what the guests and yourself would think about what would have happened if this law had been written where the states couldn't, you know, just say, oh, forget it, we're going to make the government do it all. And how would that have affected?
Interesting question.
Outcome?
Thanks, CJ. Mm-hmm. Let's hear from Abby first.
So I should just say first that there's actually been, this administration has done tremendous things when it comes to using technology in a better way. So Clay can speak to it, but the Presidential Innovation Fellowship has brought in talent and innovation in a way that's, in my opinion, without precedent. So they've done really tremendous things to bring high-quality, interesting people into government to do great things with technology. And in particular, in this instance, I mean, it's funny because HHS, so the Department of Health and Human Services, before Health.gov actually was a leader internationally around the way in which they use technology. They opened up more data than any other agency. They built better software than any other agency. They brought in senior technology leadership like Todd Park and Brian Sivak to really move the needle.
And so while this specific instance hasn't been ideal with healthcare.gov, overall they've really pushed forward an agenda of making government work better through technology.
Which might be why there were such high expectations that this administration could get it right.
Yeah.
Why it was personalized.
I think that's right.
I think to answer the caller's question, though, I think what we would have seen is some states being successful and some states being failures. I don't think we would have I think we would have seen the same amount of failure and different sets of pieces. The issue here is almost a theological attachment to a particular development methodology that has been shown to fail time and time again. And it's basically, it works great for battleships and space shuttles, but not particularly great for software. And that's this idea that we can build the whole thing and then throw it on over the wall and hope that it works.
We have an email from Adam that's interesting along on this point. He says, hi, thanks for the show. I've been running tech companies in San Francisco for 20 years. Two things. You'll be happy to know that healthcare.gov is getting fixed. I know because several of my best engineers, among the best in San Francisco, have been called urgently onto the project in the past 2 weeks. Good people who can fix it. Second, for 10 years, I ran a company that took many government contracts. I'd say the biggest issues result from affirmative action. It's more important to be a minority female veteran than a great engineer. That creates more cronyism, not less. Secondly, the employee requirements are too tough. Try to find a great Bay Area engineer who doesn't smoke pot occasionally. It's nearly impossible. Thanks for that, Adam. And I'd like to go to his first point, which is this interesting point that they are now able to have the flexibility to call in whoever can fix it after this failure. Why couldn't that have happened earlier? Obviously, people knew that this wasn't going to work. Why wasn't there the urgency, say, 2 months before the rollout to do what they're doing now?
Because you've touched on a very important issue. They measure the wrong things. Generally, when government measures the outcome of success for a project, they measure two things. Cost, whether or not the project is on or off budget, and schedule, whether or not it's on or off time. And as long as those reports trickle up, there's no one at the top who will sort of intervene and fix things. And in this case, the project was on time and on budget, most importantly on budget. And to get to the sort of affirmative action comment, there are plenty of women and, you know, African-American women veterans, or I don't know whether there are plenty of African-American women veterans, but I know that minorities and women know how to code just like white dudes know how to code. The problem is that the barrier is too high inside of government for competent women and minorities, or competent people, for that matter, to register and compete for contracts. And I guarantee you that if you enabled people to register for those things, you'd see those set-aside contracts would work even better than the way that they work now.
Let me try and squeeze in one last caller. Brian in Palo Alto, welcome to your call.
Hi. For the last 25 years, I worked on federal government software contracts for NASA and the Space Station, the Air Force, Underwater Systems Center back in Connecticut, etc. I can tell you that the best people are not going to work for large bureaucracies. The people who are dynamic, creative, motivated, they don't get along with large bureaucracies. Who has the largest bureaucracies in the country? Obviously, it's government.
Abhi, do you want to, you kind of seem to say that this trend is not necessarily true.
Yeah, I think what's changing is you're seeing people who are willing to step up. I mean, I totally hear you that working in a large bureaucracy is a challenge and hard, but you're seeing people want to do it. So as a data point, the first year of the Code for America Fellowship when we finished up, so we ran about 20 to 30 fellows a year. When we ended the fellowship the first year, we asked, how many of you would want to work for government? Scarcely anybody raised their hand. The second year, because they worked with interesting new people in those governments that weren't there before, about a dozen, about half of the people said that they would. And this year, we're actually seeing people actually go sign up to work with government. In fact, one of the fellows from last year is now the open data manager for the city of Pittsburgh.
So we are seeing a change. That's good to end on that note of optimism. So speaking of change, what are your prescriptions for change? We only have about a minute and a half, Clay. So very quickly, what are some of your prescriptions for how to fix this?
I think the first thing to do is emulate what the UK did after their sort of healthcare.gov failure, which is to create a cabinet-level position for technology and to make technology decisions centralized and in-house and to hire good people. The National Institute of Health has the highest paid people inside of the federal government but that are not elected, and it's because they're doctors. And we need to start treating programmers like doctors too. Loosen the hiring requirements and hire great people, and they'll do great things.
Fred, what are your prescriptions for change? Are you still with us?
Comment from the very beginning about user-driven development. We need to focus on the people, not on the technology. How do actual people use these things, and what do they need to help them to use it?
And Abhi, very quickly, what's on your wish list for change?
You got to create a space to experiment. You got to let people know that they can try new things and not get fired for it. And that might be a new office, new set of skills or whatever, but it means letting people have that space.
Letting people have that space to experiment, which would be a pretty big sea change for government bureaucracies, right?
Yep.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you all for joining us. We were joined by Abhi Nemani, who's co-executive director of Code for America. That's the technology organization dedicated to reinventing government for the 21st century. We'll put a link to that information and everything you heard at yourcallradio.org. Clay Johnson is a former presidential innovation fellow and lead programmer for Howard Dean's 2004 campaign. He's the chief executive officer of the Department of Better Technology, which is a nonprofit that develops technology for governments, and he's author of the book The Information Diet, A Case for Conscious Consumption. We were also joined by Fred Minlin, who's Associate Director for Technology Integration at the Central California Writing Project, which is part of the Department of Education at the University of California at Santa Cruz. We will put all of this information and links to more tools at yourcallradio.org. You can also post your comments there, your recipes for change, and shout outs to good organizations. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. How will the implementation of the Volcker Rule improve financial regulation? On the next Year Call, we'll have a conversation about reforming the U.S. banking system. The Volcker Rule sets guidelines to limit risk-taking by banks. On January 10th, a new set of rules will potentially make it harder to secure home loans. So how robust is the U.S. banking system? Are reforms working? Join our conversation on the next Year Call with me, Holly Kernan, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.